This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. More than a billion people around the world don't have access to electricity, but there are efforts to power up these developing countries and the people who live there. One man with a plan is Jim Rogers. He's the former CEO of Duke Energy, the largest electric power company in the country. Jim Rogers has written a book called Lighting the World, and he joins us now to talk about the book and the future of electricity. Jim Rogers, welcome to the State of Things. Good to have you here.
Thank you. And Frank, it's great to be here with you today.
It's probably goes without saying, but we should talk about, I mean, that's a large fraction of the world's population without electricity. And you talk about some of the hardships of going without it. You point them out in your book. It seems like it goes without saying, but you can give us a short list of what it means to be in a rural area in some other country and not have electricity.
It's amazing to me to know that one out of six people on this planet have no access to electricity. And their life is fundamentally different than the life we know here in the United States. It's different in that when they want to study at night, they don't have light, unless they read by candlelight or they read by using kerosene light. You think about women, the number of women that have babies at night. There's roughly 1 billion people that go to medical clinics with no electricity. And think about delivering a baby in the dark. And that's one of the realities for women in these low-income countries. The other reality is education. If you think about the number of children that go to grade schools where they have no electricity, it's about 50% of grade school children in these low-income countries.
And women bear a disproportionate burden when it comes to gathering the material for, if you don't have electricity, then you're talking about kerosene and wood, and that is very often getting that material is women's work. Or considered women's work.
It's hard work. And actually, there's a great book written by Robert K. Rowe about Lyndon Johnson. And he has a chapter in there that's been a motivator for me in my career as CEO. And I read it in the early days. And the book is about the life of women, I mean, in the United States in rural areas. One out of 10 farms in 1930 had no access to electricity. And in that book, he talked about how it transformed the lives of women to have access to electricity.
So you talk about in your book the fact that if this is going to happen in these rural areas and other parts of the world, we're probably looking at a strong emphasis on renewables and smaller grids, right?
Yes. I believe that solar electricity will be cheaper than building huge central station plants, transmission lines, and distributions. It will be cheaper than extending that grid to these remote areas. Also, it matches perfectly with capability to pay because you can scale up solar technologies as people get on a trajectory of increasing earning capability and increasing power needs as they move from solar lanterns to refrigeration to TV.
And some of the businesses you point out, even today, there are businesses in developing countries where just charging your electronics is a business. So if you had a small solar plant that could put somebody in business recharging cell phones for a while, that's the beginnings of an economy that could support a much larger grid.
It is. And actually, these companies, these social entrepreneurs who are in these remote areas providing electricity, they recruit people in these villages to help them market the product. They recruit people to basically provide operation and maintenance services. So it creates jobs in the process of deploying electricity.
So what are the costs? What are the barriers to providing electricity and developing some of these renewable grids in remote areas of the world?
The number one impediment seems to be, in most countries, seems to be the government. They subsidize kerosene, or they subsidize power. They make it more difficult to import the equipment to provide solar. They put tariffs on it to make it more expensive. So there seems to be a need for governments to be supportive and to support efforts to accelerate deployment in these remote areas.
What about, are they working with NGOs, and how does that work? Because certainly there must be an interest among some NGOs to get electricity in some of these areas.
There's a great interest. If you think about the provision of electricity is foundational. It's foundational to providing health care services. It's foundational to education. It's foundational to more efficient farming, improving the irrigation, the yield of the crops. And a remarkable statistic is that 50% of the people in these remote areas make a living either farming or working in the agriculture sector. It's identical to the number of people in the United States that were in the ag area in 1900.
And we had, I mean, an electrification program that was very much government sponsored. It was an intentional program on the part of this government. The market more or less followed. The first thing is, let's build the infrastructure. We'll do that as a community, and then later the businesses can be private industries that grow up around that. Is that happening in other parts of the world, or is this all market driven? We're living in a new world now, where you know, market forces seem to be the answer to everything, even in developing countries. Have we gone past the time when we can have these sort of government sponsored programs?
I don't think so, for a couple of reasons. The provision of electricity and the role of governments are inextricably linked. And even in the United States, with the passage of the Rural Electrification Act, it brought electricity to the remote parts of this country. The government was able to backstop the building of central station plants, transmission and distribution, to allow providing electricity to the rural area. The government needs to create franchises very similar to what we did with the Rural Electrification Act in the remote areas, but then auction them off to private companies that will bring capital. The big difference between the U.S. in 1930 and many of these countries is that the government had the financial capability to backstop it. Not true in these low-income countries. So what you really need to do is create a government franchise, attract private capital to stimulate the building and provision of electricity in these villages.
Can that be done kind of on an international scale? In other words, can I build this investment company that's investing in a number of countries abroad and sort of be the kind of the holding company for all of these projects, and then each country as an independent project sort of takes part in that? Can it work that way, or is that just an impractical model?
I think it's a practical model, but you have to think about this as all local.
Right.
Because, you know, people have gone from virtually the beginning of time with no electricity in these villages, so there's an educational role that needs to be fulfilled. There is a lot of these companies are most effective when they get leaders in the village to support the effort to bring electricity. So my belief is this is going to take time, it's going to take capital, it's going to take different business models, but we can do it, and we need to do it, because think about this, Frank. Think about how many Thomas Edisons, how many Steve Jobs, how many Bill Gates that are in the 1.2 billion people, and how they could transform our life. And today, we're missing that talent because they don't have the ability to get the education, the health care, to make a difference.
You talk about renewable energy being so important to the future of the developing world. We have not gone to renewable energy in any appreciable way in this country. Is it not as important for us? Is that not our future as well in the United States?
I think the United States started at a different place. I mean, our mission in the 20th century was to provide affordable, reliable electricity, to provide universal access. And actually, the National Academy of Engineers said the electrification of America was the single greatest engineering achievement of the 20th century. So yes, we did it. Now we're in a period where we're trying to make the electricity cleaner. And that really started with the Clean Air Act. And quite frankly, the provision of electricity in the first place in the early 1900s cleaned up our cities, where we were burning coal and wood. And it created, I mean, you couldn't walk into Detroit or Chicago or Pittsburgh. You couldn't put your hand in front of it. You couldn't see it. It was like Beijing today. And so there was originally, by provision of electricity, a cleaning up. Now we're cleaning up the power sector. And in that context, renewables play an increasing role. Only 5% today, but it will grow in the future.
Well, will it grow fast enough? You know, you pointed out that one of the big impediments in developing countries is governments, particularly where they place their incentives. If they're incentivizing kerosene, it's hard to go to renewables. Well, right here in North Carolina, the Energy Renewable Portfolio Standard is now going to come to a halt. There's a bill that would limit the expansion of those portfolio expectations. Isn't that a message that we don't want to move forward as quickly as we can in renewables?
It would be a mistake in North Carolina to freeze the renewable portfolio standard where it is. North Carolina is one of the top states in the United States in the provision of solar electricity because we have the right government support. We've been able to really accelerate the deployment of solar in the state. That should not be stopped. And those who are proposing it are not taking the long view. They're taking a short-term view. And we need a long-term view as we transform the energy infrastructure in our state.
Well, one of the arguments that they will make, those who want to limit the want to freeze the portfolio standards, is that it's going to cost us too much, that you're going to push energy costs up, and that could be a damper on economic activity.
Here's the practical point. Virtually every power plant in our state, except hydro, and maybe nuclear, depending on where they allow us to extend our license from 60 to 80 years, is going to be retired and replaced. So the bottom line is cost is going to go up in every event as you replace these fully depreciated plants with new ones. So the question is the incremental cost of solar significant? Will it be an impediment to economic development? I don't believe so.
Is there a way that, because the other argument is that the government shouldn't be in the business of picking winners. Right now, coal is cheap. That's the obvious source. If financial capital, if you don't mind socializing the costs, the health costs of burning coal and privatizing the profit, then in that case, coal is cheap. And stop picking winners. Stop putting your money on somebody else's industry.
My belief is there is no perfect fuel. Virtually every way we generate electricity has pluses and minuses. None of them match up perfectly with being affordable, reliable, and clean. So what's been critical to our industry and given us great resilience is that we have had an all-of-the-above approach. The issue to me is not whether you have solar, it's how it fits in the mix, along with everything else. And understanding the pluses and minuses, the cost and benefits of these different ways to generate electricity is very important.
But the cost and benefits today aren't the same as they will be should we ever solve the storage problem, for instance. And that would require a great deal of investment if we decide that, you know, right now the storage capacity isn't there, so it means that we have to rely on a mix of coal and renewables. Should you get to the point that storage is more reliable, we might be able to wean ourselves entirely. But that would take a capital investment. Should the government be involved in that? Should we be spending our money on that kind of research?
I think in the early days, and these are the early days in the solar industry, the technology cost of solar has dropped dramatically over the last 5 to 10 years. The cost of storage is dropping. There is a Moore's Law that a lot of people believe is tied to storage. So the capability to store power is improving. In the early days, it's critical to have government support. As they become equal to other alternatives, then the government support goes away. So from my standpoint, it makes sense And the fact of the matter is nuclear, which is the only technology that produces electricity 24/7 with zero carbon emissions, there was subsidization of that in the early days. Now we have 20% of our fleet in the United States, 64% of our carbon-free electricity comes from nuclear. So in my judgment, it's subsidization in the early days as it gets more economic is not a bad answer.
Are we doing enough now, do you think, at the state and federal level to subsidize research into renewable energy?
I think we clearly see that how wind costs have come down and the need to continue the subsidy on wind, I believe, is not as critical today as it was in the early days. I think in time I can envision where the subsidies for solar go away, but not today.
Should there be more incentives? You know, there's been a criticism recently of Duke Energy for not allowing solar customers to sell all of their power back to the grid. The theory is if more customers knew that they could actually make a couple of bucks at the end of the month, if they have a good month, more people would get involved, and that would push the technology, that would push the energy. But this limitation on credits only and only for what happened that month, not being able to sell to second customers, that this places a real limit. Should we lift that and let 1,000 flowers grow here?
Well, I think the important thing is people should be given the opportunity to build solar on the rooftop. They should have the ability to sell it back. The issue is at what price? If you're making sales for resale, which is a very technical term under the Federal Power Act, if you're making those sales, then you ought to sell it back at the wholesale price, not the retail price. Mm-hmm. So the issue is not whether, the issue is at what price. And I think we have yet to determine what the fair price is.
Is there, you know, you talked about the fact that this business goes back over 100 years, the generation of electricity, and it was a huge technological breakthrough. Do you think that we're being held back, that there's a kind of corporate culture, just because the business is so old, that's slowing down the progress, that we could make faster progress if it weren't for some of those holdover ideas?
I think what's slowing down the progress is that the infrastructure that we build is so cheap. And because of the low cost, it makes it difficult to shut down plants and build new ones. So it's really about the cost. I mean, in the United States and North Carolina specifically, we have some of the lowest cost power in the world. And for solar providers and wind providers to compete against such low cost is tough. It's easier to compete in California, where the prices are high, easier to compete in New York, where the prices are high, but difficult to compete in North Carolina. So it's really more of a cost of existing infrastructure versus the cost of new infrastructure.
Getting back to your research around the world and trying to light up that part of the world that has yet to receive electricity, are you optimistic? Do you see signs that some of these changes are actually happening?
I do. I believe in September, the UN will make access to electricity one of their sustainable development goals. I believe it's critical that the UN make access to electricity a basic human right because it's so foundational to everything else. And I believe there's growing momentum. USAID has been very active. They have the Power Africa program, for instance. So I think there are, you could see many lights being lit. You see a lot of new things happening. The only question is, how do we accelerate it? Do we wait 30 years for everybody to have access, or do we wait 15? That's the challenge.
Jim Rogers, former chairman and president of and CEO of Duke Energy, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Jim Rogers' new book is called Lighting the World, Transforming Our Energy Future by Bringing Electricity to Everyone. You can find out more at our website, stateofthings.org. Just ahead, we preview the National Folk Festival in Greensboro and then the music of Dale Watson. It's all just ahead on The State of Things. Stay tuned.
Well, I know my day's gonna get better when I smell that bacon frying in that pan. A fresh brewed cup of coffee, two eggs over easy. She knows how to make a happy man. My baby makes me gravy. Hey, little